indicate that longer time served is not necessarily a deterrent.
Longer time served is not as effective as other means of using incarceration. When you compare what is called certainty, which is the certainty that you'll be punished given that you committed the crime, against what's called severity, which is the time served, that the deterrent effect is greater with certainty than with severity. Furthermore, that's the deterrent theme. The incapacitation theme is that the longer you serve, the more likely it is that you'll be serving time after you finished your criminal career, the time when you would have been criminally active. So that longer time served is not a very effective way to reduce crime. It's much more efficient and effective to deal with certainty, getting people while they're active offenders, and finding ways to enhance that certainty than it is through increasing the severity of the sentences they serve. We have been on this kick of increasing sentences. I think an important part of the political environment that has contributed to that has been the growing importance of political sound bites, TV sound bites, in political campaigns. It's easy to, in a 30-second sound bite, to have a cell door slamming and to show that you're a tough guy than it is to talk about the complicated trade-offs between how much punishment you want to send out, how much money you want to invest in rehabilitation, how much you want to invest in schools, in job creation, in job training, and so on. Those don't have the political appeal in a frightened country of a cell door slamming shut. And so as we've moved to the sound bites as a basis for political judgment, and as we move to soft on crime as a profound political epithet, we have moved into an era of increasing punishment. And that's been an important factor in this growth, this quadrupling of the incarceration rate.
Have you met with judges and attorneys and those who make the sentences to try to educate them to your way of thinking?
One of the things I did was Dick Thornburg appointed me to the Pennsylvania Sentencing Commission, and so I was one of about a dozen members of the commission, and people would come to the commission and say, I want to have the sentence for X increased. And I was the one who usually would say, well, what crime would you like us to reduce the sentence for in order to make the room for the additional prisoners for the sentence you want to increase? Usually people were flabbergasted by that question, and they would stammer and say, well, that's your problem, it's not my problem. But all the political pressures are for increasing the sentence and not for decreasing it. Obviously, that commission had always been chaired by a judge, and I testified at the Congress, I've testified at the legislature on some of these issues to try to bring them to the attention of the people who make the decisions. In the second panel I chaired at the National Academy of Sciences was one on sentencing reform. The title of our report was Sentencing Research, the Search for Reform. That was a time when sentencing guidelines were really coming out, and so here was an opportunity to report to the public on what we knew about sentencing guidelines, to consider what different ways they might have been. And I understand that report became an important document for the whole variety of sentencing guidelines commissions that were established subsequently. So that was another opportunity to get involved in the policy implications of the research that was going on, some of which I had been doing.
Earlier you were talking about your concern for the increase of handguns, and that really is the main issue now.
And handguns particularly in young people.
Okay, and here we are sitting now in, we just had in April of 1999 the Littleton, Colorado massacre in the schools, and we seem to have so many of these throughout the whole country. Can you enlighten us of this terrible tragedy going on in our schools?
It's a horrible tragedy. This is number six or seven in the last year and a half or so, starting with Pearl, Mississippi. There's an enormous amount of copycat going on. There's an enormous amount of discussion about the aberrant behavior of these kids who do it.
How is it that so many people do copycat and are inspired by that?
In any given school, I think it's reasonable to anticipate that about 10% of the kids are aberrant in some way, are outliers in some way, are looking for some way to establish identity, to get even, to send a message to parents, to peers, to the peers who have dissed them. And kids have always engaged in, teenagers have always engaged in aberrant behavior. That not all teenagers, but there's always been a group who do strange things. The horrible piece is the availability of guns, high power guns, high firepower guns, that enables them to kill and injure multiple people at one time. And that's really been the dramatic change. Fighting has always been a feature of male teenage dispute resolution. Kids have always fought. The gun is a major equalizer, so that little kid can pick on the big kid, or the single kid can pick on the multiple kids, but the consequences are lethal. And we're in a situation where these kids now have access to guns that they didn't have before, and access to high power guns. Most who've done it may not have been able to think of it on their own, but when they learned about it, that triggered the thought that they can do what these other kids have done, and that's where the copycat comes from.
And how can we stop getting these guns in their
hands? Well, number one, you're working on the kids is not going to do it. You've got to work on the sources of the guns. Parental responsibility for leaving guns lying around that kids can get access to is one vehicle. The adults are the ones who can display responsibility. Trying to find ways to limit sales of guns. We passed a Brady bill some years ago that precludes guns in the hands of people who have criminal or history or mental health history, so that there are a variety of ways to, and it turns out that obviously someone sufficiently intent will find a straw purchaser or other means, but it turns out people who've been denied a gun by Brady bill do less gun crime than people who've not been denied a gun, so that there is some effect. But there's a loophole, and that is anyone can buy a gun at a gun show. So we now have legislation introduced to limit access to require a background check at a gun show, associated with purchases at a gun show. So there's a variety of efforts to try to get tighter control over gun markets. In Littleton, this 18-year-old girlfriend bought the guns for not quite 18, boyfriend. 18 seems like a pretty immature age to even permit handgun purchase. And so I would argue that at a minimum that the eligible age should be 21, and if I had my druthers, I'd push it to 24 or 25.
Why is the National Rifle Association so powerful to try to, their feeling is that there should be freedom to purchase these?
There is an obsession about the freedom to purchase that Freudians have linked to maleness in terms of a gun. But they are taking the Second Amendment and using it for an almost obsessive position on the right to have arms. The word regulated militia is in the Second Amendment, and apparently the courts have never seen fit to, have always accepted the degree of control. So there is this natural tension between the NRA on one hand and handgun control on the other, and other gun control organizations. Somehow or other, they have the legislatures in their pocket, largely because they have had enough members who they can mobilize on the one issue of gun control or no, state legislatures and the Congress have been astonishingly responsive to the NRA. I think we've started to see some turnaround. There used to be a coalition with police, but when they came out against control of what were known as cop killer bullets, that diminished their support by the police. I think the public is becoming increasingly incensed at their operation. They had this convention in Denver, right near Littleton, with the NRA, with the Littleton survivors really picketing them. So I think their political position, which has always been one of enormous strength, has weakened somewhat, and I hope will weaken further. Now, the issue that when I did this research on kids and guns, I spoke to some NRA folks about their position and asked what their view was about kids and guns. And their position was, it's not the way I would put it, but they said, children don't have Second Amendment rights. So at least they acknowledged that they were not prepared to support unlimited access to guns by kids. And that was very important in pushing that issue.
Today we see so many parents who are justifiably upset and worried and concerned, since it's now in their own backyards, and schools are reacting with monitors and making sure guns don't get into the schools. Are those the answers?
Well, there are no answers, but there are ways to improve to diminish the risks. One thing you can't do is try to predict who are the kids with aberrant behavior who are going to become the Harrises of Littleton, because there are too many of them and the base rates are inherently low, so you can make lots of false positive predictions. What you can do first is get much better information fed into the schools about who are the kids who are likely in the near term going to be doing this, who are making the threats, who are carrying the guns. There's a rule, federal rule, that requires kids who bring a gun to school to be expelled. Expelling them isn't going to do a heck of a lot of good because they still have the guns. They're going to be outside. They're going to be on the street, and they could end up showing up in the school if they're going to do these terrible things. Many places have put them into alternative schools, which involve much more supervision, much more care, much more attention. It's also the case that there's the opportunity for much greater surveillance of the kids who have been identified as a short-term threat, an immediate threat. Much more attention to them, checking them out when they come into school to make sure that they're not carrying weaponry. And these are inherently very rare events. It's also crucial that the schools develop plans for what they do in the event that someone does come in armed. So there are a lot of things that could be done to lower the risk. We've seen in the last, the Littleton event was 2 weeks ago tomorrow, and in the last 2 weeks, we've seen alerts in many places of kids carrying guns to school. And schools are inherently safe places. Not much goes on. I think in a recent academic year, there were 100 murders in and around schools. That's a large number, much larger than we would like, but in the context of there being 4,000 to 5,000 murders of school-age kids in a year, in our total murder rate of about 20,000 per year, that's a very small number. So schools are inherently safe places. Kids are not safe people. But we have to worry about those things.
How does criminology in the United States compare with other cultures?
Criminology in the U.S. as a scientific discipline is probably far and away the leader. In most places, criminology has much more of an ideological content than it does empirical. And in the United States, say 20 years ago, it may have been somewhat balanced between ideological and empirical. But today, there's no question the empirical people have the are the dominant ones in criminology. The American Society of Criminology must have, I'd say maybe 2,500, 3,000 members. At their meetings, they get at least 2,000 people showing up, many from overseas, and there's nowhere the kind of bulk volume that there is in other countries.
Tell us about your involvement professionally and
in criminology.
Yes, and some of those achievements.
Let's see. When I finished the work of the Crime Commission in 67, I went to a meeting of the American Society of Criminology. That meeting had about 30 people, or maybe 50 people, in one of the lounges at the NYU Law School. And it was just a tiny bunch. Meetings today are much larger, I think in part because the government has started funding research in criminology in the 70s and 80s, and that gave rise to the growth in the field. I became involved in a variety of ways. I remember... I have been involved in parallel, really, in the operations research profession and in the criminology profession, operations research being methodological and criminology being substantive, and sort of operations research is people at advanced technology activity. And I remember one of the early criminology meetings, if I wanted an overhead projector, they said, well, you'll have to pay for it. And I said, this is outrageous. How can you have to pay for something which is a necessary part of communication in a meeting? Some years ago, I was awarded the Sutherland Award, which is their top award for research, basically based on the research I had done on criminal careers. The criminal careers research was interesting because it was a direct outgrowth of this work in the 1979 National Academy of Sciences report on incapacitation and deterrence. The notion of incapacitation inherently involves the issue of a criminal career. That is, and we introduced a concept of crimes per person per year, crimes per offender per year, and we used the standard stochastic process designation for that of lambda. Lambda is the Greek letter for the rate of committing crimes. And so here was an important concept, and it was important that be identified. In many respects, it should be as important to criminologists as the speed of light is to physicists. And so we identified this concept of lambda, that is the crimes per person per year. The criminology world was very distressed at a Greek letter being introduced into their midst, at symbols taking the place of concepts, and so there was a lot of anxiety in that, but it's a major theme because you want to get the high lambda people in prison, the people who do a lot of crimes per year, and not waste prison time with low lambda people. Also, the duration of a criminal career was an important part of it. You want to get people incapacitated while they're active, but not after they leave. So I think it was the work on criminal careers that had been a major piece, major factor in the Sutherland Award, which I don't remember, was probably the early 80s. And then in, I guess, 91 or so, I was asked to run for president and was willing to do that. And so,
of
the American Society of Criminology. And so I ended up serving as president that year. And it was a very different culture than I had been used to because it had so much more of an ideological content. All of my time in defense, all of my time at Carnegie Mellon, the cultures I had dealt with were essentially empirically driven. I had been very active in the operations research profession. And again, ideology hardly entered there. And I remember when I gave my presidential address at the American Society of Criminology, I'm sorry, when I gave an address when I got the Sutherland Award, I talked about my feeling being similar to that of an immigrant. I had come from a different culture and so talked about the various culture shocks that I experienced when I encountered the world of criminology. And I was clearly in the opposite camp of the ideological group known as critical criminologists, whose basic view is that there's corruption by powerful people driving criminal justice. And so I remember one of them came up to me afterwards and said, "What do you have against immigrants?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You talked about immigrants in your address." And I said, "But I identified as an immigrant. I wasn't being hostile to immigrants." They saw what they wanted to see, and the notion of scientific approach to any endeavor was just not something that was central to their thinking.
Thank you.